Hair thinning can happen for so many reasons. Whether it's stress or hormones or anything, at Nutrafol, we've learned that real change starts below the surface. Our hair growth supplements take a whole body approach and target the key root causes of hair thinning, so you can see visibly thicker, stronger hair in 3 to 6 months.
Hair growth starts from the inside at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek, and I am very grateful to be joined on short notice today by two returning champions. We've got Ganul Tol, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, the author of Erdogan's War, A Strongman's Struggle at Home and in Syria. And we've got Jean Bajelan, associate professor of history at Missouri State University. He's also the host of Talking History on KSMU, and we are going to talk about the PKK. Thank you guys for coming on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us, yeah.
So just to catch people up, if they're not already aware, what we had on Thursday, we're recording this on February 28th, so just yesterday, February 27th, Abdullah Öcalan, the imprisoned leader, founder of the Kurdistan Workers Party, or PKK, has been in prison since 1999, issued a statement calling on the organization to disarm, to hold a party congress to dissolve. This has been anticipated for at least a few months, going back to the, now famous incident where Devlet Bahçeli, the nationalist leader in the Turkish parliament, shook hands with Kurdish legislators back in October. The negotiations on it around this had apparently been going on well before that. So given, and this is to both of you, given that this was sort of expected or had been expected for a little while now, was there anything that stuck out to you in Öcalan's statement, anything that you were expecting to be included that wasn't, anything that surprised you that it was included? What was your overall impression of the statement?
Well, I was expecting this to be a vague statement because we had heard before he issued the statement that Turkish government was micromanaging the whole thing, because President Erdogan, whenever he mentioned this process that was going on with Abdullah Öcalan and the PKK, he always framed it as a Devlet Bahçeli initiative. And I think that was his way of distancing himself from the process in case things did not work out. He just did not want to deal with a nationalist backlash. And from previous experience in 2013, that's exactly what happened. He publicly owned the process, and when things didn't work out, he paid a price for that. So that's why he really distanced himself and he pursued a parallel track of increasing repression on the Kurds, not just the PKK, but also on Kurdish political movement. So that's why he always wanted this statement not to be seen as a quid pro quo. Because Erdogan always said, this has nothing to do with the Kurdish problem. This is Turkish state trying to end a terrorism problem. So when he framed this in such a narrow way, he wouldn't want Abdullah Öcalan to put democratic rights, legal framework, anything that has to do with the broader Kurdish question. Erdogan did not want those things in the statement. And that's why there was no mention of that, except one of the members of the delegation who read out the call, Öcalan's letter, right before he started reading the letter. He mentioned that if we wanted anything to happen, if we want this initiative to be a long-term solution, it has to be within the framework of a legal framework, and also democratic demands must be met. So that was the only thing. So from my point of view, the Öcalan statement was quite vague, and that was by design.
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you've been following Öcalan's kind of intellectual journey over the last 20 years or so, it has been heading in this direction for a while. I think Öcalan in the statement has gone further than he has in the past. You know, there have been rebrands of the PKK in the past. There have been attempts to do these kind of Congress initiatives. But here, you know, it feels like he's kind of end of historying the Kurdish movement, because the statement frames, you know, frames the Kurdish movement in this long historical struggle. He talks about, you know, there's a brotherhood between Kurds and Turks, and that brotherhood has been shattered by capitalist modernity. Kind of very academic language, almost to extent. But really what gets to the kind of punch of this is at the end, where he's basically says the PKK was of its time, that time is over, the armed struggle is over. And what's striking, and I think Dr. Toll made this point, is that it's very vague. But what is striking is what's missing. As you say, there's no discussion of anything such as decentralization or municipality types of government. Everything is framed in this kind of democratic society language, which, you know, you can wish cast whatever you want onto that language. The key question really going forwards is, A, you know, how seriously is the PKK cadre going to take this? Nothing was included in the statement about Syria, which I think the end of the Syrian civil war, or what we think might be the end of the Syrian civil war, I think this is an important kind of context going on here. So Muslim Kobani, the SDF leader, was like, well, you know, this is great. Doesn't really have anything to do with us. So there's going to be a lot of questions. How do these people lay down their arms? Where are they going to go? What's going to happen to organizations like the SDF or in Iran, PEJAK, these kind of sister organizations of the PKK? So honestly, you know, from the reactions amongst Kurdish nationalists I'm seeing, especially, you know, those who are inclined towards the KDP and things like that, who are, you know, interestingly enough, you know, they're saying, well, this is just a complete surrender. So the real question that's going to come forward is, like, how powerful still is the Abdullah Öcalan cult, right? Is he going to, through force of charisma and personality, be able to impose this? Or are the PKK leadership in Kandil and the fraternal organizations, are they going to find some way to come out of this? And then question, what is the process? How does this take place? How do you disarm? How do you what does it mean to reintegrate into the Turkish state and society for these people who have been up in the mountains for some 40 years?
So, Gene, I want to come back to the question of whether the PKK is going to heed this statement. And I think we can talk more about that. Ganul, I want to turn to you first and talk about the Turkish aspect of this, because I know you have another interview to get to. So let's talk about the process that brought us to this point. And you know, in the same sense that Öcalan has some constituencies to manage on his side, Erdogan clearly had some constituencies to manage on the Turkish side. I think, you know, it's obviously no coincidence that this began with the leader of the Turkish Nationalist Party going over in very publicly in parliament, shaking hands with Kurdish legislators. And that was the real public kind of, you know, beginnings of this, or the you know, beginning of the unveiling of this process. What do we know about what's gone on to sort of pave the way for this?
Well, you're absolutely right, Derek, because I think the fact that Bahçeli initiated this is telling, because no one in previous instances where the Turkish government held these talks, initiated these processes with PKK and Öcalan, the problematic part, if you remember the one in 2009, basically Turkish government said that we will allow the PKK members who are in Mahmur camp in Iraq to come back to Turkey, and that will be the beginning of the process, and they won't get arrested, and then we'll go from there, and we'll take steps to address Kurdish demands. So that's how the initial opening, Kurdish, quote-unquote Kurdish opening, started. But then it backfired. Why did it backfire? Because Turkish newspapers covered it in a very nationalistic framework, saying that this is the surrender, we are surrendering to the PKK, because the Kurdish political movement welcoming these PKK members made this, turn this into a huge show of victory. And that really did not play well with Erdogan's nationalist constituency. And the second one that was launched in 2012, again, Erdogan publicly endorsed this. He wholeheartedly supported this. And he framed this as a not just ending a terrorist organization, but also addressing the bigger Kurdish cause. And there, too, he met with this nationalist backlash, and that cost him votes. And we saw that in 2015 June elections when he lost the elections, the parliamentary majority. So this time, Devlet Bahçeli initiated it because no one would really question his nationalist credentials. So Erdogan, from Erdogan's point of view, this was the safe option, and it was smart. And Erdogan obviously has his own reasons to be doing this. I think the primary motivation, the primary goal is domestic. It's always, when you talk about Erdogan, it always comes down to him wanting to stay in power. So I think the primary motivation is that.
So this is, you know, leads into my next question, which is what does that mean? And people who are not familiar with the structure here, I mean, Erdogan is looking at what should be the end of his final legal term in office in 2028. And how much of this is about kind of building as much parliamentary support as he can amass to amend the constitution so that he can hang around past 2028?
I think that is his primary motivation, because right now he has a huge problem in his hands. He cannot rerun in 2028, and he made it clear that he wants to. So to make that happen, he has been taking steps, one of which is he is transferring members of parliament from opposition parties. So right now he has 323 seats in the parliament with the new transfers. But that's not enough. He needs to secure 360 so that either the parliament can call for early elections or they can draft a new constitution. So I do think that Erdogan's plans for 2028 and beyond is the primary motivation here. But that doesn't mean that this whole opening, if it succeeds, is not going to serve his regional interests.
Domestically, the other factor here, I would say, is Erdogan's growing, I mean, still growing, I think, you know, sort of authoritarian approach to governing. You mentioned, you know, at the same time that he's sort of behind the scenes, you know, organizing this statement from Öcalan and talking to Kurdish politicians, he's still throwing Kurdish politicians in prison or deposing them, you know, and mayors and, you know, kind of, you know, overthrowing them, removing elected mayors and putting in government officials in their place. There's still a growing sense of authoritarianism. He's going after legally the mayor of Istanbul, İmamoğlu, who's probably his you know, top challenger in terms of a rival for the presidency. So what does this mean, you know, the possibility of a settlement to the PKK crisis that could involve some you know, broadening of rights or protections for the Kurdish population in the context of a presidency that just seems to be increasingly, you know, moving in an authoritarian direction? Like, what are the tensions between those two things, I guess, is my question.
Well, that's exactly why I'm very skeptical about this Öcalan opening. And I'm saying this as someone who backed wholeheartedly previous Kurdish openings, because I've always believed that if you don't resolve the Kurdish problem peacefully, you cannot put Turkish democracy back on track. So right now I'm finding myself in a spot where I really don't think this will work in the long term, because consider why the PKK emerged in the first place, right? It emerged in a context, and it emerged because Abdullah Öcalan founded this in 1978 in order to secure rights and recognition of identity for the Kurds. So in his letter, recent statement, he said that that's all, everything on that front is great now. Well, it isn't. I mean, just in December, people were thrown in jail because they spoke Kurdish and they danced to a Kurdish song. So Turkey has never been this autocratic before. So that's why, and also add this assumption to this picture that Kurdish problem, PKK is just one part of that. And it is the result of that, right? So it's not, we don't have a Kurdish problem because we have the PKK issue. We have a Kurdish, we have a PKK because we have a Kurdish problem. So that means that if you don't address the bigger democratic demands, this arrangement, whatever it is, it's not going to provide a long-term solution. And you might think, well, Erdogan doesn't need long-term. All he needs is to get what he wants. And by probably 2027, he's going to call for early elections. And one last thing about what you said about this increasing repression. So I think, yes, and it's not, Kurds are not Erdogan's only target. Both Turks and Kurds are suffering. NGOs, human rights activists, media, politicians, Turkish jails are full of them. So I think Erdogan, this is part of Erdogan's strategy going into 2028. He hasn't yet fixed Turkey's economic problems. That's number one. And two, it is really maybe in the region, regional developments may be working in his favor, but he's still facing a lot of challenges and he doesn't want to take any risks in 2028. So that's why he's on the one hand pursuing this very heavy-handed approach, very repressive policies vis-a-vis everyone who are opposed to him, but also with regards to the Kurds too. He's still jailing Kurdish political politicians and he's still removing Kurdish mayors. And again, that is part of his plan to insulate him from a backlash if things don't work out.
Jean, briefly, I did want to get your take on the Turkish political aspect of this and domestically what Erdogan is looking at.
Yeah, I mean, I largely agree with what has been said so far. I think, you know, it's very telling that the Turkish state has chosen Öcalan as their interlocutor. I mean, within the Kurdish movement more broadly, you have the armed insurrectionist wing, the PKK, but especially in the 2010s, you had the emergence of HDP, and then obviously its successor, Dem Party, and you had, again, charismatic leaders. And it's interesting, for example, the Turkish, Erdogan tried to use Öcalan in 2019 to kind of push Kurds in Istanbul, who are a not insignificant constituency of the voting population, into supporting the AKP. It didn't work at the time. But, you know, it is telling that the Turkish state is moving with these kind of undemocratic individuals rather than trying to sideline leaders of the PKK and work more closely with those who have operated within the constitutional order. And I don't think that is an accident. You know, Öcalan's legitimacy is based on the armed struggle, whereas, you know, groups like the HDP and things like and their successor organizations, their legitimacy is based in democracy. I think Selahattin Demirtas is still in jail on trumped up charges. Why Öcalan as opposed to maybe launching an initiative with Demirtas? These are the kind of interesting questions. And I think, you know, it speaks to the fact that this is an attempt to consult, I think rightly, you know, as has been said, you know, to consolidate political power around the AKP. This is not, you know, the first time in Turkish history where you have the kind of repression plus symbolic concessions. You know, for example, you go back to, you know, the late Ottoman period, you know, the Committee of Union and Progress, at the same time as mass arresting Arab activists in 1913, conceded all the kind of cultural demands. So you have this kind of, with one hand you give, with the other hand you take away. And to speak to the question of repression, you know, whereas in the 90s, the repression of Kurdish activism was kind of extrajudicial, you know, shooting people on the streets, disappearing people and things like that. Today, you have, let's say, a quote-unquote less violent form of repression, but a more total and bureaucratic form of repression. The scale of the purges of Kurdish political activists is really at a level I don't think we've seen in modern Turkish history, because they're not just targeting political leaders of the organization. It's just relatively low down people. If you've maybe attended a rally or a meeting or something like that, you could just get put in jail on trumped up charges. So I think that the kind of, you know, I hope that this works out in the long term. But again, like Dr. Tol, I'm kind of skeptical about it because of the way that it's been executed.
I want to move into some regional aspects. And Gunil, before you go, you've obviously written a book about Erdogan's involvement in the Syrian civil war, and there are potential implications here for Syria. Certainly the Turkish government would like there to be implications here for Syria. Muslim Abdi, the commander of the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is, you know, at its core, a Kurdish-led group, said this has nothing to do with us, which I don't think even he believes is the case. What is Erdogan hoping to get out of ending the PKK conflict in terms of his issues in Syria? Is he trying to isolate the SDF? Is he hoping that the SDF will disarm along with the Kurds? This all comes obviously in the context of the SDF negotiating with the new Syrian government as well. But what is the Syrian aspect of this in your view?
So Erdogan wants several things in Syria. He wants the SDF gone. He does not want to see an autonomous Kurdish region. So that means that the Syrian Democratic Forces are dissolved. And he wants them. He wants the PKK members who are part of, who are under the umbrella of Syrian Democratic Forces, those who are not Syrian, he wants them to leave the country. Where to, we don't know. Maybe Iraq, maybe somewhere else. But he wants them to leave. And he also has long complained about American support for the Syrian Democratic Forces. So if all these things happen, that will solve another problem for him, which is that really strained Turkey, Americans' cooperation with the Syrian Kurdish militia, strained ties. So if that's gone, that will remove a huge problem from bilateral ties. So these are all the things that Erdogan wants. So will he achieve those things? So several things. After Assad was toppled, there's now a new interim government in Damascus, and they've been holding talks with the Syrian Kurds, the Syrian Democratic Forces. But the talks have been derailed. And Damascus basically wants the same thing as Ankara from the Kurds. And the talks have been derailed mainly because the Syrian Kurds say, okay, we understand you want us to be dissolved and we are happy to do that. You want us to be integrated into the new Syrian National Army and we are happy to do that. But we want to be integrated as a bloc. So that tells me that they understand Damascus does not going to grant them any federal or autonomous structure, but they still want to be able to retain some form of autonomy, right? So that's been their demand. And for Damascus, that's a red line. And for Erdogan too. So that's why the talks have been derailed. So imagine a scenario where the parties cannot reach an agreement, right? The Kurds say no, and they remain there. What are the options? Option number one, and this was threatened by Damascus, Damascus would move in and launch an attack against the Syrian Democratic Forces. Damascus does not want to do this. It's not ideal, especially at a time when Ahmed al-Sharra, a Syrian president, wants to look cute to the Western world, secure their backing, right? So he does not want that. He wants this to be resolved peacefully. Erdogan doesn't want that either. But let's imagine nothing happened. So what is the number two option? Because Damascus, let's remember, Syrian army is not militarily capable of taking on a group as strong as Syrian Democratic Forces. We're talking about tens of thousands of armed men who are capable of fighting. So Damascus is not militarily capable. And in that case, Turkey could come in, right? But Erdogan also, that carries a risk for Erdogan too, especially at a time when he doesn't know what Trump will do. He doesn't want to piss the new American president off. So that's why it's a very tricky situation. But if things don't get resolved, that might be the course that we're looking at. And that will complicate a lot of things, including Öcalan's recent initiative to disarm the PKK.
So Gunilla, for everybody who's listening, Gunilla has a heart out here. She's got to get to another interview. I want to thank you so much for coming on the program. We really appreciate your time. And again, folks, the book is Erdogan's War, A Strong Man's Struggle at Home and in Syria. Go pick it up. Gunilla, always great to see you. And we look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much, Derek. Bye.
Desk.
So, Gene, I want to continue on here, and I want to ask you the regional question as well, but I think it might make sense to take a step back and talk a little bit about the history of this. Ocalan's history, the PKK insurgency, like what do people need to understand about this conflict to understand what's happening now?
Well, if you look at Öcalan's statement, you know, he talks about the history of the PKK and the political context in which the PKK came into existence, you know, the you know, not just the conditions existing within Turkey, but also the conditions existing globally at the time. This was still the Cold War in the late 1970s. Turkey was an extremely polarized country. And between the 1950s and late 1970s, you kind of had two strands of Kurdish political activism in Turkey. You know, one strand of political activism sought to work within the constitutional framework of the Turkish Republic. You know, Turkish political parties were often looking, you know, for there was a kind of Tammany Hall of the mountains where tribal leaders could deliver big blocks of votes. And so, you know, you often had a lot of tribally connected people entering into the parliament. And some of these individuals, not all of them, some of them assimilated into the Turkish mainstream, but some of them sought to use that position, for example, to deliver better goods and services to the Kurdish provinces, to, like, you know, have some, I forget the name, but, you know, one deputy used his parliamentary immunity in order to get a Kurdish dictionary published, that kind of stuff. And that movement kind of petered out. And then you had, you know, the left-orientated movement cooperating largely with within the Turkish left, you know, being a part of the Turkish left. So Öcalan kind of comes out of this milieu of the Turkish left. And, you know, because you've had the failure of both a kind of constitutionalist and a socialist revolutionary kind of approach to the Kurdish question, you end up with the PKK, which combines like Kurdish nationalism with revolutionary socialism. Öcalan talks about this, you know, and initially their objective is the, you know, creation of a united, independent, socialist Kurdistan, encompassing not just the Turkish, Kurdish regions of Turkey, but, you know, across the region. But it's also important to recognize that, you know, some of the PKK's first targets were not Turkish state targets. You'll often read that, you know, the first PKK operations in 1984 were directed, you know, directed against the Turkish state. But, you know, in the late 70s, you had attacks against other Kurdish political parties, including the Socialist Party of Kurdistan, which was more of a kind of autonomous movement, and against sort of tribal leaders. So this was also, you know, a kind of a class struggle organization as well. But over time, obviously, that has metamorphosized. You have the, you know, beginning in the 90s, there's a kind of move away from this kind of more radical, traditional, you know, Maoist, Stalinist kind of socialism towards, you know, you have the end of history. You know, that's why I, you know, say Öcalan's statement is kind of end of historying the Kurdish movement, because he says, well, it's all over now. You know, the conditions that gave rise to the PKK, you know, don't exist anymore. The global conditions don't exist anymore. Socialism is dead. So the PKK has kind of, since then, I think, being searching for a new political identity, you know, a new ideological formation as well. So, and with Öcalan's capture, you know, while in jail, Öcalan has kind of embraced a kind of radical liberalism. Yes, yeah, so Öcalan has, you know, basically embraced a kind of radical liberalism, drawing on kind of Murray Bookchin anarchism, which I think in America was very popular in the 2000s. And that has kind of, in a garbled form, come to define the ideological orientation of the PKK, as well as its sister organizations. But, you know, without Öcalan's leadership, over time, you're seeing the various Kurdish political organizations go along their own paths. So on one hand, when the Turkish state talks about the SDF being a branch of the PKK, it's true. But on the other hand, the SDF is pursuing its own sort of political goals in Syria. This is not unique in the in Kurdish history. The KDP of Iraq and the KDP of Iran are now very different political organizations, but the KDP of Iraq was initially founded as a branch of the KDP in Iran. So, you know, there's a kind of almost a kind of political gravity in Syria that is pulling the SDF to become a kind of Syrian political party. So I think there are kind of tensions that people, you know, want to paper over between, you know, what Öcalan might want, what the leadership of the SDF in Syria might want, and of course, what the people up in the mountains in Kandil might want as well. So the Öcalan is kind of, you know, it all comes down to Öcalan's charismatic authority, right? Öcalan and the PKK, you know, developed an extremely powerful cult of personality. I remember talking to a PKK supporter, you know, quite educated and wealthy PKK supporter in Europe years ago, and asking, you know, how do you justify this cult of personality? And it's like, well, the Turks have their Atatürk cult, and we, in order to kind of break the kind of hold of that cult, we need our own cult. We need our own leader. But, you know, Öcalan is a kind of mercurial leader. When he led the PKK, he, you know, led it into several military disasters. He often removed capable commanders as well. You know, for listeners who want to read something in English, you know, there's the book Blood and Belief, which I think is worth having a look at if you want to have a kind of overview of the PKK. So, you know, the PKK is trying to find a place in this process because they're not only threatened by the Turkish state, but they're also threatened by the growth of groups like the HDP, people like Selahattin Demirtas, who, you know, have greater democratic legitimacy you know, politically speaking. You know, I would argue that, you know, Demirtas is probably a bigger threat to Erdogan than Öcalan could ever be a threat, because Öcalan is a deeply hated person in Turkey. And, you know, what's quite striking about this is, like, you know, you've had 40 years of Öcalan being a baby killer and enemy number one. And now everybody's, you know, it's like the Ribbentrop Pact that they're making. You know, they're like, okay, you're the bad guys for years. And suddenly Öcalan is going to become a partner in peace. You know, it's an interesting question about where this is going to go, especially because Devlet Bahçeli is the person kind of who is going to be the patsy for whether this works or doesn't.
So maybe this is, before we get into to regional questions, let's talk a little bit more about this idea of, you know, Öcalan's purchase with the PKK at this point and with the Kurdish community at large. It's one of the responses or the reactions that I saw in the reporting about his announcement was like he's calling on the PKK to surrender, basically, and there's no indication that he got anything out of it. And there's been talk of, you know, Öcalan's going to be moved out of solitary confinement, that, you know, other Kurdish politicians, maybe Demirtas, maybe some others are going to be released from prison, that there may be down the road some, you know, legal protections for the Kurdish language or Kurdish culture. But there's nothing in the statement to indicate that he got anything. It was all about, you know, the conditions are changed. The struggle has to end. Like, let's just call it quits. And so I wonder to what degree there's going to be some frustration on the part of the PKK and of the Turkish-Kurdish community at large. And to what extent these people who are in, you know, who are fighting, who are still in open rebellion, dealing with the Turkish military, are going to be willing to consider laying down their arms with no apparent guarantee for their safety or their future?
Yeah, I mean, this is the million-dollar question, right? Because Öcalan has given this statement where, you know, he's called for an end to the armed struggle and, you know, a peace process before, but more, you know, this was a very direct call to disarm and surrender and reintegrate with society. But what does that mean, right? And how does that process take place? That's going to be the real question for us going forward. So, number one, let's talk about Kandil, which is the kind of mountain fortification where a lot of the PKK fighters are. You know, Iraqi Kurdistan is basically a Turkish colony at this moment in time, both economically speaking and militarily and politically speaking. Turkish soldiers are, ensconced in the region. They have more or less the kind of cooperation of the Kurdistan regional government authorities. There's no love lost between the Iraqi Kurdish political leadership, or it's more specifically the political leadership of the Kurdistan Democratic Party, the dominant Barzani-led formation in Iraqi Kurdistan. Where are these people going to go? How are you going to demobilize the PKK if you continue to have military operations? Just for example, 2 days ago, if you followed the Kurdish press, some PKK fighters went to get food from a village and they were attacked by Turkish special forces. Is that going to continue? Is the Turkish government going to let up on the military pressure? And if you don't let up on the military pressure, how are these people going to disarm? Right. So that's a really big question. Another question is, relating to Syria, a big complaint of the Turkish government is that there are a lot of PKK fighters who are not from Syria, who might be from Iran or Turkey or Iraq, who are there. They want them to live. Where are they going to go? Are they going to move them to Iraqi Kurdistan? Whereabouts in Iraqi Kurdistan are they going to go? So there's the devil is really in the detail. So how is the PKK going to respond to this? Well, one response could be, well, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to have our Congress. The ball's in your court, Turkey. How are we going to do this process? Because, as was mentioned earlier, in 2009, you had this group of PKK militants coming back to Turkey. They were celebrated, and this was picked up by the Turkish press. It was seen as a kind of capitulation to the baby killers. Because remember, you have this endless kind of anti-PKK propaganda and this kind of elision of the, Kurdish question and the question of terrorism as well. What are the optics going to be for the Turkish state? Because I'm skeptical that they're going to allow these people to return to Turkey. I think that would be politically toxic for them. We've seen the nationalist backlash before. And just because Devlet Bahçeli has these kind of impeccable nationalist credentials, it doesn't mean that there can't be a backlash against him. Erdogan may have failed in creating a pious generation in Turkey, but he has been quite successful in building an extremely nationalist generation. And so I think it would be a deeply unpopular move. The other option is, okay, move them to Iraqi Kurdistan, but where do you put them in Iraqi Kurdistan? You could put them in Süleymaniye, which is run by the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, which has relatively warm relations with the PKK and various PKK formations. But then that kind of creates, an issue there. Turkey has been very critical of the PUK and its relations with the PKK in the past. So there is this statement was so vague, and there was no indication of what, the process of even surrender would look like. Let's just say this is a surrender order. Well, then how do you execute the surrender order? Are you asking for these people to kind of just turn themselves into the nearest Turkish gendarmerie post? That's going to be, that's the devil is in the details. And also, do other Kurdish political parties necessarily want this thing? Does the KDP, for example, want Öcalan? They'll release him, which I doubt they will, but they release him from jail, but he can't stay in Turkey. Do they really want him to be sitting in Erbil in the regional capital of Iraqi Kurdistan? It's important to remember the KDP has a long history of struggle and conflict against the PKK as well. So it's a very kind of perplexing situation, because at the same time, you could make the argument that if the Turkish state was pursuing only like a kind of securitized strategy vis-a-vis the PKK, then you could make the case, okay, this is a kind of good faith attempt at reaching a peaceful solution. But the real question is, this huge wave of repression that is taking place in Turkey against Kurdish political activists who are engaged in, what we might call, constitutional or democratic forms of political activism. the law is often deployed very harshly against Kurdish political activists in Turkey. For example, you know, let's say, you know, I'm Jean, I don't like the PKK, I'm against the PKK, but I say we should have a decentralized form of government in Turkey and Kurdish rights or whatever. You could be liable to be put in jail for making terrorist propaganda because your opinion or your kind of notion of a political solution somewhat overlaps with statements from PKK leadership and things like that. You can get into trouble. For example, Nevşir Mengü, who's a journalist, went to interview Salim Muslim from the SDF, is now in jail. So you're having this huge wave of repression. And I think it's really important to understand this repression is, you know, a very modern, like it's a very Kafkaesque type of repression. So, you know, people are getting put on lists, being dismissed from jobs. You know, it's like just a very deep penetration of society. You know, I mentioned earlier, you know, compared to earlier waves of repression where they would like gun down intellectuals in the street or disappear activists in a car. It's not like that. You just tie people up in kind of bureaucratic processes, put people in jail, intimidate people and things like that. So it's very hard to see at the very moment where you're seeing a kind of ramping up of repression, the removal of these Kurdish men, like what is this? What does a peace process look like in this context? You're going to make a deal with Öcalan to do what? The PKK disbands and then you continue these things? You know, nothing seems very clear to me. It seems to be the Turkish state is no doubt in a position of strength, right? Vis-a-vis the Kurdish movement, that's for sure. But the question is, like, why do this when you're pursuing the repression strategy? You know, obviously, I think that there was an attempt here to kind of bring in Kurdish support to kind of boost Erdogan's regime, but it just doesn't seem like a kind of feasible process because, you know, when we look at peace processes in the past, yes, you kind of you talk to the militants, but usually there's a kind of democratic wing of the movement that you want to try and, you know, engage with, right? And, you know, a good faith peace process will generally try to elevate those kind of peaceful voices over the militants. But here, the Turkish state seems to be deliberately privileging the PKK in this process, while at the same time launching this huge assault on Dem Party, which is the successor to the HDP. If your objective is peace, that doesn't seem like a logical move to me. But of course, if your objective is to consolidate power against potential threats to you from within the within the constitutional Turkish political system, within the kind of framework of relative politics, this may be a smart strategy. Maybe not everybody will sign up to it. Maybe not everybody will agree, you know, that the struggle is over. But you know, you're kind of pulling the rug from around it. At the very least, some elements of the kind of broader PKK political military complex will heed Öcalan's words. Others might try to kind of get around those words as well, you know, and try and find a solution, try to find a way to kind of continue. You know, the PKK could dissolve itself and create a new organization, but like, what's that going to do? That doesn't change the fundamental facts of the ground. You have these militants up in the mountains. You have the SDF in Syria. You have Pezhak in Iran. It doesn't seem at all very clear to me where this is going beyond an attempt, perhaps, to use Öcalan kind of in a larger way compared to, as I mentioned earlier, what happened in 2019 with the Istanbul elections, where you know you can get arrested for you can get arrested in Turkey for like, you know, reading an Öcalan speech. But when the government does it, when Öcalan's saying, like, don't vote for the opposition party, it gets carried in Yeni Şafak. So this seems to be a kind of repeat attempt at that, where you're kind of deploying Öcalan against the Kurdish movement. And I don't know if that's feasible.
Right, right. I want to get back to the regional question and we could talk about Syria, but I want to talk first about Iraq. You've alluded to the fact that the PKK is based in the Kandil Mountains, largely northern Iraq. As a result, has become this Turkish dependency or battlefield. I mean, you know, something, you know, some combination of those things. You've got Turkish military bases in northern Iraq that I'm sure the Iraqi government would like to have gone. There's nothing they can do about it. But I'm sure they would like an end to this conflict, both to get the PKK out of you know, the region and or out of, you know, that part of Iraq, and to get the Turks out. At the same time, you've got the KDP, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, which is the ruling party in Iraqi Kurdistan, and, you know, the Barzani family business. They've played an interesting role here in terms of, it seems like, mediating between the Turkish government, with which they have they have pretty good terms, and then the PKK, with which they have a very rough history. They, you know, fought a war against the PKK and PUK in the 90s. You know, have not generally been on good terms, but they've mediated. They've had Muslim Abdi from the Syrian Kurdish movement, you know, they've hosted him in Erbil to talk about this stuff. Let's talk about the Iraqi context of this, and especially the role that the Barzanis seem to be playing in this process.
Yeah, I mean, the Barzanis have their own interests in all this, especially in Syria. There are a series of political formations which are anti-SDF from a kind of Kurdish nationalist perspective, who are aligned with the KDP as well. You know, so I think, you know, the KDP would like to see, you know, its proxies in Syria in a better position. You know, Syria and Kurdistan is kind of has been a battlefield between the KDP and the PKK to a certain extent, and the PKK have won that with their kind of fraternal organization out maneuvering for a number of historical reasons. We're able to be in a far better position than the KDP's kind of fraternal political organizations. But, you know, obviously the KDP will talk to everybody, you know, because they also have to kind of maintain legitimacy amongst their base as well, right? You know, as I said, you know, de facto, Iraqi Kurdistan is an economic, military, and political colony of Turkey. That's not necessarily a very comfortable position for the KDP to be in an ideological space to be in. You know, their legitimacy is rooted in kind of holding the nationalist high ground. And obviously, if you're seen as kind of yes, you can be PKK for ideological reasons. You know, they're communist, they're like against traditional Kurdish culture as well. That's fine, but you don't want to be at least too much seen as doing the Turks dirty work for them as well. So trying to play this role as a mediator, as a mediating force between Turkey and the kind of PKK political complex, you know, it was a smart move for them. The Barzanis are, you know, masters of kind of, you know, playing various sides off against one another. So, you know, we're going to see how that goes for them, because I think, yeah, the KDP wants this resolved. It's not ideal for the KDP to have, you know, Turkish airstrikes, you know, hitting Iraqi Kurdish civilians all the time. It's not a good look for them to not be able to control the territory of the Kandil Mountain, to have this kind of insurrectionist group there operating, annoying Turkey, which they need to maintain good economic and political relations with. So, you know, they have a big interest in seeing a resolution to this conflict, but they're kind of trapped in two positions. They're like, internally, they're kind of, you know, it would be great for them if the PKK could be just wiped out and eliminated. I don't think they have any kind of fondness for the PKK. But at the same time, they have to keep one eye towards maintaining their nationalist legitimacy. The KDP has no other, you know, the KDP is a kind of, what other plank of legitimacy do they have to lean upon beyond this kind of nationalism that they have? So trying to play that mediating role, I think, makes sense for them. We'll see where it goes, because they have a big interest in the resolution of this conflict.
Moving to Syria, I wanted to get your take. Obviously, Gunul already talked about what the implications might be for the SDF. As you look at this, what is it? What do you see this development? What effect do you see this having on the Syrian Kurdish channel?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the real wild card out there. I mean, as I noted earlier, you know, the SDF were like, yeah, this is great, but this doesn't apply to us, right? Because the SDF is, you know, really trying to, tries to distance itself from the PKK while at the same time being kind of ideologically simpatico with the PKK. So they're in this very weird position. Like if you go to Syria and you say, oh, you know, I'm here to meet PKK militants, so they'll say something like, a journalist told me this, they'll go like, what are you talking about? There's no PKK here. The PKK aren't based here. Obviously, in reality, there's significant ideological overlap between the two organizations and also an overlapping cadre. You know, there are people, you know, the Syrian government for years turned a blind eye to Kurds joining the PKK. You know, it was a good way to kind of channel Kurdish nationalism outside of Syria. You know, when the PKK declared their objectives for being a kind of for creating a, you know, united socialist independent Kurdistan, you know, they very quickly said, well, Syria doesn't count, of course, because, you know, Kurds in Syria are just refugees from Turkey, which ironically is the kind of Arab nationalist discourse about Kurds in Syria, that they're not really from Syria anyway. But yeah, the question is going to be, how do they react to this? Now, on one hand, if you want to be really positive about this, reducing the threat of the PKK, having a process with the PKK takes away the kind of casus belli from the Turkish state. Like, you want to go after the SDS while you're engaged in a peace process with the PKK, and the reason you want to go after the SDS is because they're the PKK. Well, that creates, I mean, not to say that, you know, politics is not necessarily consistent or logical, not to say that they couldn't do that. But, you know, that would seem to me a rather weird maneuver to engage, you know, if anything, if you wanted a kind of casus belli against the SDF, you would intensify the conflict with the PKK. You would ramp up assaults in the hope of having some kind of response, which would lead to, you know, well, we're going to have to cross into Syria to wipe out this domestic terrorism threat. But if they're creating a peace process to deal with this domestic terrorism threat, one of the big issues for, you know, one of the big kind of at least superficial reasons for the for any cross-border operation is taken away. So it's a kind of strange situation to be in. And I'm trying, you know, I myself am trying to work through this. You know, a lot of talking heads or pundits like myself, you know, will try and prognosticate about what's going to happen. But I think we just, you know, have to accept here is like this could go, you know, a number of different directions because there are a bunch of tendencies and counter tendencies that seem to be, you know, working in opposition to one another. So, you know, when we talk to what Ankara and Damascus one. Yeah, they want a kind of centralized Syrian state. You know, they would be happy to have SDF forces integrated into the Syrian military, but they want people to integrate as individuals, which, you know, is a logical position to hold. You want to kind of consolidate your nation. You don't want to have armies within armies. You don't want, you know, they've done this with all the Islamist militias. The problem is from the SDF's position, it's like, well, okay, we need a peace process, but what guarantee do we have that you won't go back on this peace process in the process? You say that you're going to recognize cultural rights, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, back in the 1970s, one of the things that propelled Saddam Hussein to power was the agreement to solve the Kurdish question in the 1970s. They came up with an agreement to create an autonomous region, established a parliament. If you go to Iraqi Kurdistan and you look at the parliament building in Iraqi Kurdistan, who built that? Saddam Hussein built that, right? They established a Kurdish autonomous region. But of course, that Kurdish autonomous region was completely stripped and devoid of any kind of meaningful autonomy. And, you know, we saw some of the most brutal and violent repression against Kurds take place after the so-called, you know, recognition of Kurdish political rights, the creation of like a Kurdish language department at the University of Baghdad, you know, the creation of a Kurdish language curriculum. So, you know, the SDF desire to maintain some kind of military autonomy is also perfectly understandable. You know, their stated objective is not the creation of an independent Kurdistan. They don't want to secede from Syria, but they want some kind of sort of autonomy and some type of way to guarantee that autonomy. Now, of course, at the moment, the presence of the United States is their kind of like and excuse the pun, Trump card. You know, it's the kind of the only thing they have. You know, one of the interesting,
ironically, Trump may wipe out their Trump, may take away their Trump card.
He might take away their Trump card, but you know, I don't know which way Trump is going to go on this. Right? He could go either way. He could be, you know.
I mean, we do know that he tried to abandon them once before. So, like, it's got to be at least at the front of mind, right?
I think people
have been down this road before.
We've been down this, yeah. And then he changed his mind. And, you know, it's my firm belief that he changed his mind because someone said, you know, there's oil in Syria. Why are you going to give up the oil? And then he was like, oh, well, we better stay and take the oil. Now, and I, you know, for your Substack, I wrote an article. It's like, this could go anyway. Yes. You know, Erdogan could placate Trump. You know, he could, you know, play to his vanities, give him some sweet deals. You know, Trump says he gets on with Erdogan. You know, if you read John Bolton's memoirs, you know, of the Trump administration, he was like, Trump was very impressed that Erdogan had these big rallies, et cetera, et cetera. And so you could have this kind of like corrupt authoritarian like solidarity between the two of them, which could turn into some kind of quid pro quo. That's for sure. But there are several countervailing forces within the Trump administration that would gravitate against that. First of all, you have the old neocons, you know, out there who are, you know, who are out there being very, you know, who are very, let's say, who want to maintain a presence in Syria. They haven't been convinced by Al-Qaeda's rebranding in Syria, so they want to stay in there. You know, they have a close relationship with Israel. You know, Israel is launching this assault in the south of Syria. You know, America. You know, they'll be like, well, America should stay here. We don't want to, like, give away our position. So you have that kind of tendency. And then you have a kind of cultural, you know, anti-Muslim, Islamophobic sort of impulse, especially amongst the evangelical base and more evangelically oriented people who don't like Erdogan, right? Erdogan imprisoned that missionary, which Trump had to negotiate, if you remember, during his last Andrew Brunson. You know, like, this was a big cause celeb. Amongst the evangelicals, like the Turks were persecuting this poor missionary guy who got, I think he was like accused of being both Fethullah Gulen and PKK at the same time. So, you know, you have this weird situation. So you have Marco Rubio has been like kind of at the forefront of being hostile towards Erdogan. A lot of people, you know, the Israelis don't like Erdogan either, you know, that he's seen as a kind of enemy of Israel. And of course, as we know, Israel has a lot, or at least pro-Israel thinking has a lot of influence on the on these guys. So it's like, which way are we going to go? Who's going to win out in this kind of political battle? Because, you know, Trump, you know, I think one of the reasons Trump kind of rolled back the pullout of Syria in the first place, why we're still there and he didn't completely rule back, was because I think he didn't think that he was going to get so much pushback over this withdrawal from Syria, right? I think he thought this was going to be an easy win. He's going to kind of bolster his kind of America First stuff by pulling out. And then suddenly he had all these constituencies around him who was quite close to him, neocons, evangelicals, are like, whoa, whoa, whoa, this is not what we want. You know, this is not how we want it. This is not the thing we want to give up on. So, you know, it's a real tough question. So the SDF, I think, you know, they know that the American, you know, if you talk to like anti-imperialists, they're like, oh, why did the Kurds always sell out to American imperialism when they know they're going to get sold? So, well, they don't really have many options beyond, you know, relying on the United States to be a guarantor. I mean, we see this in the Iraqi Kurds, right? The Iraqi Kurds are very like, want to keep the U.S. military presence in Iraq. You know, Erbil International Airport is like just this huge complex where the United States can use. So it's going to be an interesting situation because, you know, the Syrian Kurds don't really have any other kind of leverage beyond the American presence, right? Because yes, the Syrian armed forces as they are at the moment might have a difficulty fighting the SDF. But you get Turkey involved and, you know, they will – the territory of Syria is not this kind of mountainous region. It's very flat. They can roll in armored divisions. They can, you know, move – they could occupy most of the Kurdish-held territories, I think, relatively quickly. They might face a guerrilla insurgency, but, you know, that's – they will have defeated the kind of – autonomous region there. So it's going to be it's really going to be, you know, I don't know where this is going to go, right? There is a desire on the part of the SDF and I think also Damascus to resolve this issue, but there is this just sticking point of like, how do you guarantee an agreement, right? And the SDF is saying, well, we want to be incorporated into the Syrian military structures as a collective. The Syrian government doesn't want to do that. Turkey doesn't want to do that. But from their perspective, the only other option is to kind of like disband and hope for the best. And if you're a student of Kurdish history, as many of these people are, that's not necessarily going to work out.
We
saw this story play out in Iraq in the 1970s. I don't think anyone wants to see a repeat of that.
So I guess my last question, sticking with the regional aspect of this, and we can probably wrap it up for now here, but it's been the least discussed and I think the least apparent, at least to me, is the Iranian Kurdish angle to this. Like, what happens? Let's say this process does make some headway, despite all of the uncertainty about what's involved, despite all of the, you know, the very nebulous nature of this announcement and what it might mean. Let's say that the PKK does engage in a peace process and it does make progress. There is a move to maybe ceasefire, if not outright disarmament. Let's not go that far down the road. But there are some, there is some, you know, significant shift in that conflict with Turkey. What are the implications for Iranian Kurds and the implications for the Iranian government?
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting question. I mean, I tend to think, for example, for your listeners, there is a kind of sister organization of the PKK operating within Iran called PEJK. And, you know, my general thought is that it probably won't make that much of a difference to their military and political activities. You know, as I mentioned before, it's not the first time in Kurdish history where you have a kind of pan-Kurdish organization established, but then over time, the various kind of constituent parts of it develop their own kind of political and military identities and become effectively separate organizations. So I suspect that will probably, you know, let's say you have a kind of resolution of the PKK, you have a resolution in Syria, but you don't have a resolution in Iran. I think you'll continue to see kind of on and off conflict between the Syrian Kurds. And, you know, the PKK aren't the only players in town in Iran.
Right.
You know, you have KDP Iran, you have Komala, you have various political organizations.
I mean, is it possible that you could see a movement of fighters from, you know, people who are dissatisfied, you know, PKK fighters who are dissatisfied in the negotiations with the Turks, or Syrian fighters who are dissatisfied with how that, you know, their situation is unfolding, who go to Iran as sort of, you know, the last open conflict here? I mean, if things get far enough, is that something that,
I mean,
that
I
is
think,
possible?
I think you'll see. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a kind of inevitability, right? That you'll have some of the militants crossing. The question is what scale, right? I mean, and for what reason? You may have people out there, you know, like the Chechen fighters who go around the world as the kind of Islamist International. They've just been up in the mountains for so long. They like do the fighting life. That's what they do when they go to Syria. They go to Iran, and that's the new front, right? But I think what you're pushing at is, are we going to see kind of a broader, like kind of like ideological kind of shift in orientation? That I don't know. I don't know how that will play out. Maybe there are going to be questions, for example, about, you know, depending on the regional constellation of forces, you know, are the Iranian Kurds going to have a patron, right, to support their activities? Are they going to be able to operate? You know, for a long time, Iranian Kurdish political parties were able to operate in Iraqi Kurdistan on an understanding with the Iranian government, where the Iraqi Kurds would keep these guys in camps and keep them away from trouble. And in return, the Iranians wouldn't, like, wipe them out, right? Well, we have to see if that continues, right? Because if you remember when the Iranian Kurdish protests were took place back in, what was it, 2023? You know, time all just melds into one at my age. You know, once you, when you go back to that, you know, the Iranians struck a number of Iranian Kurdish bases inside Iraqi Kurdistan, right? So what's going to happen with that? Because, you know, as we've emphasized, this Öcalan statement only refers to Turkey. It does not refer to the broader pan-Kurdish political context. So where things will go in Iran, it's difficult to know. The Iranian government has deployed an enormous amount of repression in Iranian Kurdistan over the last few years, so things are silent. But, you know, there are tensions bubbling up in the country, and not just in the Kurdish regions of the country as well, in the Persian regions and the Baluchi regions. And so, you know, a lot of things are going to depend what happens in Iran as well. And I've written for you before about this, you know, Kurdish movements in each part of Kurdistan have this kind of weird liminal space. They're in this weird liminal space. What I mean by that, on one hand, they're kind of profoundly impacted by developments taking place within the nation state they live. Iranian Kurds are affected by what happens in Iran. Turkish Kurds are affected by what happens in Turkey. And very much their politics is geared towards the kind of domestic conditions within the states that they reside. But at the same time, there's this pan-Kurdish field, which is a little bit more ephemeral, but it's kind of like a domino effect. Like, if you have a resolution of the Kurdish question broadly to people's satisfaction in Turkey, Syria, and Iraq, that's going to have an impact. Even if there's no kind of direct military support for Iranian Kurds, even if the kind of border is sealed up, you know, that's going to have an effect. It's going to be an example as Iranian Kurds look like. If you're an Iranian Kurd, you go across to Iraqi Kurdistan, and it's not great, but you can drink a beer in public. Nobody oppresses you for being Kurdish, you know. It's like, why can't we have that, right? Even if it's not great. So, you know, like, whether or not it's intentional or not, what happens in, you know, what happens in Turkey, Iraq, and Syria is going to have an effect on Iran. And what that effect will be, you know, will there be a move of fighters from, you know, different parts of Kurdistan into Iranian Kurdistan? Will there be a kind of indigenous Iranian Kurdish sort of civil society movement rising up inspired by changes in other parts of the Middle East? That is an open question. I guess we're going to have to see how things play out. But, you know, to return back to the kind of main point, I am very skeptical about this process. I hope it is successful. I would like this conflict to end. It is like it is a needless, you know, waste of life and resources. But will we get there while you have the Turkish state suppressing Kurdish civil society and political activism and trying to make a deal with a guy who they've called a terrorist for 40 years and who's been sitting in a jail for 20 years? Is that going to resolve the Kurdish question across the region? I don't know about that, Eric. I don't know what you think, but it doesn't sound like a fortuitous set of circumstances for that resolution.
No, I think there's a long road to go before you get to anything that could look like a resolution to this. But it is a dramatic development, and maybe it's a step towards an end to this. We'll have to wait and see, and I'm sure that we will have you back and Gunul as well to talk about this along the way. So, Gene, again, thank you so much for being here. The show is Talking History on KSMU, and Gene is regular. You guys should know this by now, so we're always happy to have you back.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
The line, and I've I've only got a shot clock's worth of time to tell you about Subway's $6.99-foot-long deal. That's right. Order now in the Subway app and get any footlong on the menu for just $6.99. Fresh sliced deli meat, fresh crispy veggies. Ah, too much good stuff. Get it now on the Subway app. Any footlong for just $6.99. Use code 699FL now. Only here for a limited time. Redeemable at participating U.S. restaurants. Subway app, online orders only. Add-ons, additional plus tax. Additional fees apply on delivery. Excludes footlong snacks. Limited time.